Friday afternoon. So, last time, more volume, okay, we talked about exploiting things on the heap. So mentioned this idea that we could have heap metadata that often is kept in your heap objects, not always, but often. And this often had a nice predictable pattern where we could use our pointer subterfuge idea that, you know, a common way of implementing things like malloc is to keep a linked list of free regions, because we don't just like allocate each region with a call to the OS. Instead, we get big chunks and divide those up. And the linked list manipulation involves following a bunch of pointers and writing a value obtained using another pointer. Yeah. And we can kind of turn this into basically an arbitrary memory write. We saw that we sometimes have these restrictions because, you know, if we're updating a doubly linked list, well, we're updating in both directions. And that maybe means we have this extra write that could interfere with what we want to do, depending on, you know, where it's going to have to end up targeting based on the write we really want to do. And we saw kind of a problem with this is that, if, you know, if we want to use the idea of, you know, like running some existing gadget, we might want to set one of the pointers to point to read-only memory. That's probably not going to work out. But often we can find ways which don't involve that, like overwriting a vtable pointer, where the vtable pointer itself, you know, points to a table that doesn't have to be executable and therefore might be writable. And also where writing to the wrong part of that shouldn't be an issue, because we just need to make sure the vtable pointer ends up pointing to our ends up having a slot for the function we want the code to be tricked into running. Then we talked about double free. So double free is kind of more of a historical vulnerability, because almost all current implementations of malloc and free explicitly look for programs that do this. But when they didn't do that, kind of they just did the natural thing in their bookkeeping of their list of free items and ended up with a loop on a linked list. And this ended up with a case where we could have malloc return the same thing multiple times, and also where we could kind of manipulate that list by editing the next pointer, because it would be part of what malloc returned, because the malloc library was confused about what memory was and wasn't free. And then we talked a bunch about use after free. And this is kind of the most relevant of these exploits, because it's often the most common way we have exploits today, because it's a problem you can't fix by just making sure you don't go out of bounds, which we'll talk probably more about, like how do we avoid doing that later. But the conceptual idea is that if you don't care about having an if statement every time you do something like an array access, not going out of bounds is easy. Fixing the use after free problem is not so easy. If you have a reason to have two pointers to something, then you need to have some sort of better strategy that's not really going to be a thing where you can just, you know, systematically insert a check every time you access a pointer to make sure that you aren't allowing one of those pointers to be freed without the other being updated, and therefore have a dangling pointer to a freed object. And we saw the way that this actually got exploited wasn't that we were modifying the freed memory or reading the freed memory. It was that, well, when we call malloc renew again, it smartly reuses memory. We want that to happen, otherwise we just keep allocating memory and we're not. But when it reuses memory, we can have a new object in the same place. And even though kind of malloc and implementations are kind of a black box for most of us, it turns out that they, you know, often just end up reusing an allocation right away because of their structure. And if they don't, we can kind of manipulate that to happen. Either we can like run in the debugger and say, oh, when do the pointers match up? Like, count allocations and figure out when we can make that happen. And often we can manipulate things if we know or probably learn a little about the internals of the malloc implementation. We can figure out, okay, well, it's allocating somewhere else because the size doesn't match or because there's this big free region, and we can trigger other things to be allocated to make that less often the case. And we can actually, as an attacker, make this kind of, we have an A object and that is, you know, we have a dangling pointer to and a B object that we just allocated. We can kind of relatively consistently make that happen. Questions? Yeah. Okay, so I note that the assignment that's due next week is a use after free assignment. There's two programs to exploit, and they're both a C++ program. I'm sorry that we don't teach C++ anymore. I'm hoping that it's close enough to Java that we're not going to have a problem. But the reason we're using C++ is that, well, I want a case where there's a good reason we have dynamically allocated objects, and also I want a vtable exploit, so we're doing a very non-synthetic vtable exploit. And basically, there's a fake grading system where we have a grader object and an info object that you can trigger to be allocated with a command line interface, and you can make those go to the same place. That's the use after free bug, and then you have to exploit that. And in the first part, you can exploit it very directly. You can just modify the data fields of the grader object. In the second part, you probably need to do a vtable pointer overwrite. Okay, some questions so far, things we covered last time. Okay, so we'll finish off our coverage of use after free. So, I have this example here where I think I left off last time. And my question is, suppose we have a video object and a browser tab object that happen to be occupying the same memory location because we had a use after free. We tricked probably the browser in this case into freeing a video object, but we still had a pointer to it, and making a new tab be in the same place. And my question is, if we want to defeat ASLR, what API, you know, calls for a video or a browser tab would be useful? So if we're defeating ASLR, we want to get an information leak of memory addresses. What, you know, the operations that we might be able to call on a browser tab or a video might be helpful for doing that? Like, obviously, an operation that's just like output the address of all your pointers would be nice, but no one's going to implement that for us. But what are things that might actually exist that would be useful? Question. So we have our browser tab. When I think of it, is that we have in here, we have a pointer browser window, which has a num tabs, active tab index, and all tabs pointer that points to probably an array of browser tabs. Probably back here. Or we have the alternate view where it's a video object which starts with a codec that points to something with a pointer to a string, and a pointer to a decode function and a pointer to a seek function, and also then has a pointer to a file name and a frame rate with height and so on. All right, those are our two objects. And what we want to think about is they both have a memory layout, and the browser tab also, importantly, has a current URL, which is a string not stored with a blocker, just stored in line in the top. We want to think about how is this going to be interpreted in sort of when we look in either direction, right? So what information can we get by accessing the fields of either our browser tab? What is that going to tell us about the video object and vice versa? Oh, I guess my example is the browser tab is overwritten by a new video object. So we had one of these browser tabs, and now it has the data of the video object. So that means that our interest, so we can query the video object, but until we do something with the browser tab objects, that's only going to tell us about the video object's data, because that was just set up. So querying the browser tab object is going to tell us about the video object that occupies the same memory. What information could we learn? Yeah. So you say we could get the file name of the video. So let's think about that. So the file name of the video is this second field here. If we think of where that corresponds to in our browser tab object, it's there. So the pointer to the file name occupies the same space as the beginning of the URL. So if we get the URL of the browser tab, we're going to learn not the file name of the video, but the address of the file name of the video. So that is an ASLR relevant information leak. That we get some junk URL that doesn't make any sense, but we know it tells us about that memory address. So questions? Yeah. Anything else that might be interesting you could look up, figure out? So that's something that's useful for ASLR, because presumably that tells us where the heap is, if it's a dynamically allocated file name, or tells us where the stack is, if it comes from the stack, but it tells us where a memory address that we're not normally supposed to see. So there are some other examples where that's likely to happen. So let's think about what happens if I ask for the number of tabs here. So I'm going to follow this pointer, go to the browser window object, and take something at the beginning of it. If we think about how that maps to in our video object, well, there is a pointer in the exact same space in the video object. And if we go to it and take something at the beginning of it, we're getting the value of a part of a different pointer. So if we have something which tells us how many tabs there are in the window that contains this browser tab, we're going to get some crazy number. But that crazy number isn't going to be random. It's going to be part of a pointer address. And because pointers are probably 64 bits, if this is on a modern desktop, the other half of the pointer would be in the active tab index. So if we query that, we get the rest of the pointer's value. And those would all be crazy numbers, but they'd be crazy numbers we could turn back into a pointer address. Yeah?
So that's if you have a browser window that's been overwritten by a video?
So in this case, we just have a browser tab that's overwritten by a video. but the window is implicitly overwritten. The window pointer is overwritten, so if we access a window through that browser tab, we're going to get this sort of object, which is never, ever a browser window. Other ideas or questions or... So what I'm going to show here is that like we have this tool where just things overlap, and you know, as far as information leaks, this is a great source of information leaks if we can figure out sort of what things were overlapping. And you know, Ariama, like kind of our primary goal in information leaks is learning addresses of interesting things. And I would say that probably this information leak here is most useful because we're getting the address of the name, and the name is this string constants. And where are the string constants stored? If we, they're stored as part of whatever this executable or library is. So that will tell us, you know, if we have a copy of this executable, we can say, oh, I see H.264, where is that in the actual executable? And then I can find the memory addresses of everything that's loaded from the executable. And that would be enough, for example, for us to figure out how to do an ROP attack somewhere else. You could get that offset that, you know, if you completed the ROP assignment, you needed to figure out. Questions? So that's information leak. So let's talk about doing modifying a method. So let's say we end up with handle to a string and a file info object, and we have the ability to perform operations on them. Let's say I want to modify memory at this address. How can I do that with my two handles? So I can change the file info, and I can change the string. What can I set in order to modify memory at that particular address? And I think there are multiple potential answers. And these do depend on us like being able to set the fields of the file, but you know, changing the modification time of a file is a real thing that's, you know, would make sense to support, especially for a programming language interface, like a JavaScript. So anyone have sort of, what should our first step be for figuring out, we want to do this modification, what should we be looking for? We're going to modify memory at a particular address. Preferably someone who hasn't talked, but we'll see if that happens. So we should think about, we saw just before that we talked about use after free, we talked about heap metadata exploits, and there we overwrote pointer values in order to write to memory somewhere. Right. So where are pointer values here we could overwrite potentially? You can start by saying, well, this is a pointer value, this is a pointer value, and this is a pointer value. So it's going to be one of those three. Can we overwrite that, any of them? So anyone? Yes. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so your theory is that probably the layout here is that we have a name, which is an 8-byte pointer. We have a creation time, and if our time t's are 8 bytes, then that would mean that the modification time occupies the same space as data. If our time t's are not 8 bytes, this is unfortunate. But yeah, so that would be the most straightforward thing. If time t is 8 bytes long or otherwise padded, then it looks like data might be that, and we just set a modification time, and we have to figure out how time t's are encoded to find the correct time and year to set to indicate 0x123456789 when it's interpreted as a pointer. So that is using this data pointer. So we have another pointer we could modify. So let's start with the name pointer. This name pointer allocates the same space as Alex's size. So we can change that if we somehow make this string have 0x123456789 Alex's size. So we just choose the size of the string to be that size is, you know, several hundred megabytes, but a very particular several hundred megabytes. And assuming it doesn't round it for us, we can out-modify a particular memory location that way by setting our file name. Assuming it modifies it in place, which we don't know. Yeah, so this is, I guess, we need more information about how this actually works out. Probably I should change this example to use const to not const. So, but the most plausible is if time t is 8 bytes, then this would work. I probably should make this example more explicit in the future. So set time t. But this is like meant to illustrate, these are the sort of things you want to look for thinking about how do we exploit a use after free vulnerability. Like when we have pointers, that should be a red flag that ooh, this is going to let us modify other things in the program, right? Because sometimes, in rare cases, it's just going to be useful to have this direct use after free where, you know, the object we're modifying might be super useful to modify directly. You know, it lets us set something we're not supposed to set. But often, you know, it won't be an interesting object that we have on either side of this. We'll use this to kind of as a jumping off point by modifying pointers and things to make the operations on that object change things they're not supposed to. Okay, so here I have an example with some C code. And my assumption is here, I've got an IF stream. This is the basically the C++ equivalent of a file input stream from Java. And the internals of IFStream, which is a subclass of IStream, this is the equivalent of input stream, have a stream buff, which has this uFlow method. And our goal is that this get calls the uFlow method, which is a virtual method. It's overridden by subclasses. And our goal is to cause it to change by using our input here to modify the actual vtable pointer, right? Because what we're going to have here is we have our IF stream, which because it inherits from IStream, is going to have a buff pointer, which points to a underscore file stream buff, which has a vtable that has an entry for uFlow, and also some other data. So questions about sort of the setup of what's going on and the implementation here? So there's a bunch of indirection. So the file input stream, the IF stream, doesn't actually have a virtual get method. Instead, we have this inner class that actually emulates the file IO called a stream buff. And that has a virtual method because we have a stream buff for files and a stream buff for other things. Like we can have a string input stream. And we've freed, this is the equivalent to free in, but it also calls this destructor. So it's equivalent to really free in's buff and then free in. So we've freed two things, actually. My question is, what size should we choose? Where the idea is that by choosing the size of the allocation, we're choosing what object are we likely to be sort of getting something at the same place as, right? Because typically malloc will try to look for a slot of the same size when it's allocating something. So what size is most likely to make that happen? So I think we have kind of two sizes, right? So we can choose that we want this allocation to map to the freed memory for the IF stream. We can choose that we want it to map for the freed memory to the file stream buff. So which one do we choose? So who thinks we choose our size of our IF stream? We want it to map to the IF stream. It's going to be most useful. Thinks we want it to map to the file stream buff, and no clue. Okay, so we have a mix of them. So I think we can make both of them work. I think it is more challenging to make the IF stream strategy work. So if this allocation here overlaps with the IF stream, then what we would need to do is our input needs to construct a fake IF stream object, which has a pointer to a new buff, whose address we need to figure out. And that new buff needs to have a pointer to a fake vtable that needs to have an entry for uflow. So we can make that work. We need to figure out a bunch of useful addresses to do that, but we could do that. If we make it overlap with the file stream buff, then our exploit is simpler. We're going to have it insert our vtable pointer here, and we have to point that to somewhere where there's an appropriate slot for uflow. And in that case, our assumption would be that there haven't been enough allocations to mess up our IF stream object from what it was before it was deleted. If there was, then we'd need to resort to the other strategy. And I kind of gave the hint that we're going to choose a size that's typically matching the size of whichever object we're targeting, because that's most likely to cause malloc to choose the same memory location that was just freed, because it's going to like make sure the size is big enough, at least. And often they'll have separate slots for different size objects, separate lists for different size objects, because they don't want to waste space. Something we shouldn't do is we shouldn't like choose the size of the superclass. So the size of an iStream, which is the equivalent of input stream, we wouldn't want to use that. We want to use the size of the file input stream, the subclass, because that is what was actually allocated. We can just view it as an input stream. And similar for the stream buff, we want to choose the size of the file stream buff because that was actually created, not a stream buff, because that's just the superclass that wasn't what was allocated in memory. There's not any space for them. Some questions? Thinking about our tribal overwrite. We'll see. Okay, so I'm going to go over an example of 2012 Google Chrome exploit, which was exploited via JavaScript. So we have this nice tool where you could write a program that creates and frees objects, essentially. And this was part of like a full exploit of Google Chrome. This is just actually one step of it. When we talk about sandboxing later, we'll see why there was a whole bunch of extra steps. Also, there were things where defeating ASLR was part of this. I'm not going to talk about all the details of that. But this is kind of the important part, and this allowed arbitrary code execution via that vtable overwrite idea. So this is kind of a simplified version of what the JavaScript code that triggered this use after free looked like. That we, in the JavaScript, we create this source buffer object, and then we remove the video thing is for. And I should say, we create a media source for a video, and then we remove the video thing it's for. And there was a bookkeeping error here when that was removed. It didn't realize, oh, there's still a reference to it in JavaScript. So the JavaScript has this handle to this freed object that was deleted because we told the browser that the HTML element for the video is, please get rid of it. And since JavaScript is garbage collected, we can't have to actually trigger things to be freed, like this the parent object here. So we just triggered a garbage collection pass, which you can do explicitly in JavaScript. You might say, shouldn't we just not allow that? I mean, that's an idea. The big problem with that idea is that there's ways of kind of implicitly triggering it. It's just a little more complicated because the way a typical garbage collector works is when there's some threshold that's met, it has to, you know, free up memory so you can still allocate more things. So if we didn't have this explicit trigger garbage collector operation, we just allocate enough objects to, with high probability, cause a garbage collector run to happen. So then we have this buffer, use after freed, and then if we allocate access this, we are accessing some deleted object. And this operation, it looks just like we're assigning a value, but that's not how it's really implemented. This actually calls an accessor. So the implementation in C++ is we call this set timestamp offset method. That's what this JavaScript just assignment of a number actually turns into. And that accesses this player object that is a member variable. So in the Chrome source code, they use a style convention that things that start with M underscore are member variables or instance variables of the current object. So this is calling a method on an instance variable pointer. And this call doesn't actually use a vtable. So it looks, it's a method call, but Chrome uses this style called pointer to implementation, where most objects have a class that has a pointer in it, and they have non-virtual methods, meaning methods that don't use a vtable call, that then access that pointer, and that pointer does a vtable call. This is done for reasons of binary compatibility. The idea is that our object, if our object has just a pointer of it, we don't have to change the code that uses that object when the size of the thing that pointer points to changes. So that's why they use this pattern, but we'll see that come up because we see that this media player method here, even though you would think, oh, this is where we're going to actually change a timestamp variable, nope, we're calling this using this private pointer, and that's where the real implementation is. And for our attack here, our goal is going to be that this call is implemented using a vtable call. So this is really going to be mprivate vtable some index, and then calling a method that way. Everything else is not that. So for example, this, this call here, this is really equivalent to media player source set timestamp offset m player and the rest of the arguments. That is not a virtual call. Like, it always calls the media player method because there's no subclasses. So the one we're going to target is this one, because that's the only one that does a vtable lookup. It's the only one where there's subclasses to worry about. For the others, the compiler has been told that it's not subclasses. If this was Java, it's the equivalent of the method. All the other methods are final, basically. So there's no dynamic dispatch. And so the exploit that Pinkie Pie here came up with is they trigger our useAfterFree. And then we have a free object. We want to use this timestamp offset setting call to run a function of our choice. We want to have it be, when we run that line of code, we want it to be the case that we're not running the normal version of that code. We're running a subclass that's really something we chose. So how do we do that? Well, they allocate something that's going to replace the mprivate object. And they allocate something where they can control the entire contents. And they do this by just allocating an array of ints of the correct size. And because the allocator uses the space that was just freed, that's going to let them manipulate the entire mprivate object. And they chose 168 bytes because they knew that was the size of the actual subclass that mprivate pointed to. They also needed to make sure that when other things were allocated, that the original mPlayer object, you know, the one that has this mprivate pointer already set there, doesn't change. So their trick for doing that is they search through Chrome source code for things that have the same size as the media player object and look for something that wouldn't change that pointer when it gets created. And they found, oh, this WebRTC peer recognition happens to have meet those criteria. It makes a C++ object of the same size, and when that object gets constructed, it doesn't change the bytes that correspond to this player pointer. Great. Then that's just being done to make sure that other stuff JavaScript is doing doesn't allocate memory and mess up the freed object. So then they fill in the array for the overwritten, you know, freed private object, and they can just set the vtable pointer. It's the first two elements of that array, since it's a 64-bit pointer. They just set it to the values that they figured out earlier would be useful. So what they're using here is they had our media player object with a pointer to the implementation, which had its vtable pointer, and they sort of, and they had this player impl, and they had these, both of these were freed, but still used, and they carefully allocated two objects that they knew would map to them, and they chose these so they would be useful. So here they chose something that would map to the same place. That wasn't changed, so they knew that this private pointer wouldn't be changed. And they apply our impl, they chose this array because they knew array 0 and array 1 would let them set the vtable pointer. Now, something that comes up here is that they also needed to set that vtable pointer. They needed an information leak because Chrome used ASLR. And it turns out that their information leak was right here. Would be an example of a possible information leak. I'm not sure exactly which class they used, but there was this timestamp offset field that was a double that there was a get function for. So they chose a different type of object, potentially, that had a pointer there, and read the double. And the double, of course, after that pointer was set, was junk. But that's fine. It's junk that actually corresponds to the address of, in this example, something's buffer field. And so that gives you a memory address leak. It lets you start, you know, guess addresses and defeat ASLR. And I think that seems to be a common pattern when people find these use after free bugs, is that they're used as a tool that's exploited multiple times to actually complete the full exploit. Because depending on, you basically have a library where you choose, what do I put on my right side of this diagram, which object types do I put, and that gives you kind of a toolkit of options for leaking information and changing values in memory and running things. Some questions. So that's like, for example, use our free, and this has like been, you know, as I mentioned when we started this topic, this is like one of the more common types of sort of arbitrary code execution exploits, and it's frustratingly kind of hard to simply mitigate. Like we saw with our buffer overflows, we just like add a check before every time you access an array. That's the mitigation. Is that going to be fast? Probably not, but at least we know how to do that. Fixing use after free bugs everywhere is so much less straightforward unless you switch all the way to like use a language like Java without raw pointers. And people get very disappointed at that because that's, you know, the garbage collection, the dynamic memory allocation in Java is one of the things that frustrates people the most about using Java. Okay, so in our last few minutes, I will talk about another sort of overflow-related topic. And this is on that idea that, well, bounce checking is easy, right? You just do it. And one Carl nudge happens a bunch of times is that it's easy to do bounce checking wrong in a subtle way. So as an example here, this function has broken bounce checking. And I have the example on the side of why it has broken bounce checking. That if I pass in a length that is a very large number, what is it going to do? It's going to compute the total size. I'm multiplying that by the size of the item, and that could be too big to fit in an int. But the way that typically ends up compiling, we're going to just truncate the int. So the real value of total size should be, in this example, you know, this integer. But if our int is 32 bits, this is the part that fits in an int. And this part does not. So that gets discarded. So the length will compute the total size to pass to malloc in this case is going to be 16 bytes, 10 bytes max. But the actual length that will iterate is going to be that huge number. questions? This integer overflow. So this pattern happens, is relatively common because it's easy to make this mistake. As an example, this is an adaptation of an actual, similar pattern, similar idea. This is an actual code that was in the Windows kernel. They're outputting something as hex. They need to allocate a buffer to do that. So they take the source length, multiply it times 6, not thinking that anything would ever call this function for a source length where multiplying it by 6 wouldn't fit into the sort. So this was a buffer overflow in the Windows kernel. Just a tricky one to use because this is what you're overflowing, but something people figured out. Or as an example of a different sort of problem, this is another Google Chrome bug here, where we sort of say, okay, let's compute the size we want here. We're going to take the size of our buffer minus the size of something that goes to the beginning of it, divided by the size of the number of items, right? We have a count, and then, so we have a count, UINT32, and then a size here, of items. And so we have this method here to compute what the maximum we might need to allocate is. And the thing they didn't think of, so I guess the challenge here, can you find the bug? This one is very subtle. So there's a bug where basically compute max results will be too high. And I wrote the bug down, but what's gonna happen? Here. I wrote the scenario down. The exploit is that we give a very small buffer size. Yeah.
It's going to return a negative number, right?
It's going to return a negative number. So it seems like it's going to return a negative number, but it's not. So it's worse than that. It's going to return a positive number, but it should be a negative number. Yeah, so what happens if we say supply size of 1 and subtract that minus 4, we get negative 3 over size of t. If t is like 2, then we're going to get a huge positive number, because even though that's negative here, it's not negative when it returns a UINT32t, which is an unsigned int. And so this was, used to just get out of things. Oh, I guess I don't have time to do this exercise. Well, probably. And I guess we'll probably do this exercise next time. So something you might say is, gosh, shouldn't our compiler help us with this? This seems like something the compiler could help us with. It sure does. So the C standard says that some things are undefined behavior, meaning the compiler doesn't have to do anything about them. Signed integer overflow is one of those things. That's good, because that means the compiler can change it to do something that helps us security-wise. Unfortunately for us, unsigned integer overflow is not. Unsigned integer overflow is required to wrap around. No exceptions. So this means that if I do an integer overflow with signed integers, there are in fact options I can pass to GCC and Clang that will catch the error for me. So f standard pi is equals undefined is one of them, f track b is another. If I do unsigned integer overflow, no error, perfectly fine, no problem. Just gonna do that for you and print the wrong number. Now, we're gonna talk about Rust, and I think that's gonna be our next topic given my assignment schedule. And Rust was kind of built with security in mind, so they do by default, if you do an integer overflow, by default, they do crash. Problematically, this is happening because we're in debug mode. In release mode, it just overflows. Because it's too slow, they think, to catch this. So that's where we'll finish up. Okay. And we'll, next time, I guess, we'll talk about Rust, our previous, there is another option in Rust. It's not the default.